Today for the special seminar will be our very own John Moffitt, who you all know and love. Take it away.
Thank you. All right, the title of the talk is Assessment of the Particle Standard Model, a Reformulation. And this is a recent paper which deals with mostly of what I'm going to talk about. So the contents of the talk are here. And these are all the issues that I will discuss. And I'll end up with comments about quantum gravity. So one of the amazing, I'm going to quote, make some quotes, because they put the talk in context. One of the amazing characteristics of nature is the variety of interpretational schemes. I always found them mysterious, and I do not know the reason why it is that the correct laws of physics are expressible in such tremendous variety of ways. They seem to be able to get through several wickets at once. This is Richard Feynman, the Cornell Lectures, 1964. Another quote is, "It is not always so that theories which are equivalent are equally good, because one of them may be more suitable than the other for future experiments." Paul Dirac. And finally, since the consideration of point interactions lead at once to infinities, it appears reasonable to regard it as a limit of some smoothed-out interaction with finite radius, as this radius decreases to zero. An approach of this kind means essentially the rejection of any unjustified consideration of point interaction by means of a delta function. This is Lev Landau, 1955.
Do you remember the source of the quote? You can always find it.
Yeah, the sources for the Landau are four papers, 1954, with his students Kalinnikov and Aprikosov. And the quote from here is from an essay he published in a Festschrift collection of essays for a Festschrift of Niels Bohr's 70th birthday. I have this book. Most people don't, of course. Okay. Well, we're going to talk about the standard model. And of course, these are pictures of the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, 27 kilometers in diameter, going through France and Switzerland. And this is the ATLAS detector. And these are two pictures of actual events. The LHC shut down this past December for 2 years for upgrade. And they're upgrading the luminosity for proton collisions, and they're upgrading from 13 TeV to 14 TeV. The 1 TeV upgrade doesn't make too much difference because you have two protons colliding. Each proton has three quarks in it, so you have to share the energy, total energy, among six quarks. So if you do an experiment at 14 TeV, you can expect results already at mostly at 3 or 4 TeV, actual results for the collisions. So standard model. it's taken, the standard model of particle physics is one of the great intellectual achievements of womankind. It took 200 to 300 years to develop. And it's a remarkable story. Discoveries, theories, and as we have it today. And the particle content that we've discovered through Fermilab and the LHC discoveries makes it, as we'll see, theoretically consistent. So the quarks were proposed by Gell-Mann and Zweig, 1954. And they weren't believed at the time to be other than mathematical curiosities because they had fractional charge, 1/3, minus 1/3, 2/3. Even Gell-Mann didn't believe that they were physically real. However, subsequent work by James Bill Kane and Richard Feynman and others led to the slack linear accelerator results of electrons colliding with protons. And they discovered that the quarks, there had to be three objects inside the proton, neutron, up, down, quarks, and experiments showed that they really existed, even though we can't see them, they're confined. Now, so there's six quarks, are up, down, strange, charm, bottom, top. And there are the flavor, the quark flavor doublets are UD, CS, TB. Three, and there are three generations. As for the leptons, electron, muon, tau, nu, mu, nu, e, nu, tau, lepton flavor doublets, e, nu, e, mu, nu, mu, and tau, nu, tau. Three generations. There are six bosons. There's the photon, the gamma, WZ, the Higgs boson, the gluons, little g, and the graviton, big G. I've put a question mark next to big G because we haven't detected it and probably never will. Probably never will, okay? But still, it's the particle physics of gravity. Now, results. As of the second run of LHT before it closed down. A new paper just appeared at CERN document as of last week, in which they've looked for massive particles, heavy particles, all the way up to 2-3 TeV, using new detection techniques. And they see nothing. No new particles beyond the Higgs boson, which was confirmed to exist in June 2012. Now, this has dramatic consequences for the future of our understanding of matter. So, many theories have been developed over the years to go beyond the standard model, so-called going beyond the standard model, beyond these particles. And they haven't discovered them. In particular, they haven't discovered supersymmetry, technicolor, grand unified theories, conformal invariant Higgs particle models, and there's no experimental evidence that supports a composite Higgs boson, or that the other particles that I've just told you about are composite as opposed to being point elementary particles. So the lack of supersymmetry is significant, and it means that the reason why supersymmetry was invented, one of the reasons, in the early 70s by Vess and Zomino and the Russian physicist, is to solve what's called the Higgs mass hierarchy problem. This was a known problem over years, as I'll discuss shortly. In my opinion, a reasonable person would think at this stage that supersymmetry does not exist. Supersymmetry means, by the way, that for every particle that I've told you about, there has to be a superpartner. And the superpartner has the opposite spin to the partner, the original particle. And supersymmetry means that the mass of the particle, these particles, and the superpartners have to be equal. Well, obviously that's not true, because they haven't seen superpartners to the part to the original partner particles up to 2-3 TeV. Gluinos, photinos, so on, squawks. This is unfortunate, because much of the ideas that have been developed over years were going, the supersymmetry started in early 70s. So we're talking half a century, and it's failed. Supersymmetry has failed as a theory, in my opinion. Now, we have to go to higher energies. We can always keep increasing the masses of the superpartners. The symmetry is already badly broken, and one should continue looking. Another issue is the dark matter.
Okay, John, before you go, can you feel, so it's true that if you wanted to use Susie to explain the hierarchy problem, that's at this point a fairly hard story to tell. That I think that there's a consensus on that. But if people say that there are other reasons to believe in supersymmetry and there's no reason to believe that the Susie breaking scale is at the currently accessible scale, do you have any argument with that?
No, how can I? However, you keep raising the mass, okay? And it's going to be, I will discuss later in the talk, projects for a new accelerator. And I'll discuss that. And we can wait 20, 30 years before we have such a machine. So in the meantime, we have to do theoretical physics. Now, if you're willing to do supersymmetry, who's going to prevent you? Fine. Okay. It affects, the discovery of supersymmetry also affects superstrings, which has been going on since 30 or 40 years. Superstrings is a way to solve unified theories and so forth, quantum gravity. It's seriously affected by this too, the lack of supersymmetric particles. Now, why a reformulation of the standard model? To reformulate the theory as it stands is obviously a technical challenge. It's a complicated business. And the question arises, why would I want to reformulate it? What reason would I have to do this? And I'll explain why I think it's necessary. And, okay, so in an early paper in 1990, referred to here, in Physical Review, I developed the standard model as it is without some of the particles having been detected. For example, the Higgs boson. I included the Higgs boson field, of course. And I used standard ways of calculating perturbation theory. And I invoked a spontaneous symmetry breaking of the vacuum. However, in the following talk, in this talk, I'm going to address the following question. If at the beginning of the development of the standard model, the quantum field theory had been a finite theory free of divergences, how would the standard model have been deformulated? The 12 quarks and leptons and the weak interactions, the WZ vector bosons and the scalar Higgs boson would be discovered and complete the detected particle content of the standard model, as I've explained. However, guaranteeing the renormalizability of the electroweak sector would not have been a problem needing resolution, because a perturbably finite QFT would be the foundation of the theory. And this last part of the comment here is what I'm going to concentrate on, and I'll give you reasons why this is important. So one of the reasons is that over the development of the standard model, the weak interactions stalled development over some years. The standard model had partly its birth with the work by Schwinger, Feynman, Schwinger, and Tominaga from 1948, and work by Dyson, Freeman Dyson, 1949, 1950, 1951. Where they developed the renormalizability of the standard of quantum electrodynamics. It was very successful. For example, the calculation of the magnetic moment, including the anomalous magnetic moment of the electron, which is a finite calculation, is incredibly accurate. It goes out to 15 decimal places or more. And when you do experiments measuring magnetic moment, you look at the theoretical prediction before you decide on your experimental result. It's that good, okay? It's one of the most extraordinary predictions, calculations, in the history of physics. This is often forgotten. Now, however, with the weak interactions, which, as we know, historically started with the discovery of Becquerel, of beta reactivity, beta decay, in the 19th century, developed through all the different ramifications, stalled the development of the standard model because of the charged W meson, W boson. The charged W boson caused trouble because when you calculate these loop integrals, using this propagator, m is the mass of the W, then for large momentum, the propagator goes like this, and it turns out that power counting shows that the loop integral diverges badly. So you introduce a cutoff in the momentum integral, the virtual particle integral, momentum integral, and it violates Lorentz invariance, gauge invariance, and unitarity. And that was the problem. So this finite quantum field theory I'm going to tell you about solves this problem and guarantees that the loop momentum integrals are finite while maintaining Lorentz invariance and unitarity with a W boson mass. So the motivation for the weak part of the standard model, which is described by the group SU2 cross U1. SU2 is a non-abelian group. U1 is the abelian group. Was through symmetry and renormalizability of the model. And the renormalizability requires gauge invariant symmetry. Now this gauge invariant symmetry is true for quantum electrodynamics because the photon is massless, and it's true for quantum chromodynamics, QCD, because the eight gluons are massless. However, it doesn't work for the weak interactions, which are short range. Namely, the W and Z bosons have a mass of 83 GeV, 91 GeV, respectively. They're not zero. Okay. So, what did they do? Well, we want to be renormalized. We want infinite renormalizability to work. So we put all the masses to zero in the theory. We put the W and the Z mass to zero, and we put all the fermion, left-right fermion masses to zero. We need to do that to get SU2 cross U1 symmetry, namely gauge invariance. Okay? All right. Now we have gauge invariance. So we can do this trickery with renormalizability, having infinite coefficients cancel one another for charge and mass. And we're happy. However, what about the masses of the particles, which are experimentally determined? That was a problem. So, theorists went back to condensed matter physics and superconductivity, back to Landau again, early 50s. His theory of Ginzburg-Landau, theory of superconductivity, where a similar problem occurred, but not quite the same as the particle physics problem, because they weren't worried about renormalizability, so to speak. And the microscopic theory of superconductivity is the Bardeen-Cooper-Schrieffer theory. So we had a microscopic theory, and a part of that was what's called phonons, the sound phonons, sound speed phonons, which are like, so to speak, the W and the Z. Or the Higgs. So Ginzburg and Landau invented this potential. Phi was an order parameter, and they discovered that it spontaneously broke the vacuum. Okay. This was followed up by a paper by Philip Anderson, Princeton, and in his paper in Physical Letters, 1962, 63. He actually said that if you apply this to quantum field theory, you should be able to resolve some issues to do with non-abelian gauge theory. 1964, authors Braut, Anclair, Kibble, Goranek, Hagen, published Fitzrev letters more or less at the same time. And they borrowed from condensed matter physics. In fact, Braut was working on condensed matter physics at the time. So he knew about all that. And they showed that the photon can get a mass through an extra degree of freedom, scalar field. And Higgs got his first paper rejected, too mathematical, so he put in a paragraph at the end saying, there's a particle called the scalar particle, spin zero, which will give the photon a mass. And this could be possible to give other particles masses. So there you go, it's called the Higgs particle. And so they did this, and we have the spontaneous symmetry breaking of the vacuum, through this scalar field. And the theory is renormalizable, as was shown by Toft and Feldman in 1971. By Toft in 1971 and Feldman and Toft in 1974. So we're progressing towards the present standard model. Now, the problem is that the whole thing is, first of all, you have to accept the fact that this condensed matter physics is true for particle physics. That's not obvious. Okay. Anyway, so this leads us to one of the big problems we're going to talk about, the Higgs mass hierarchy problem. This is the formula. And this is the bare mass and the radius of correction is delta mh squared. And when you calculate it, this is what you get. This is the cutoff. So it turns out the radius of corrections diverge like the square of the cutoff. This is bad news. This is called the Gauge, the Higgs mass hierarchy problem. So it was first discovered by Weisskopf in 1939 in a paper in Physical Review. He was the first to calculate the self-energy of particles. And he calculated the self-energy of the electron and found it's proportional to the electron mass. So when the electron mass is small, you don't have a problem. And it's also logarithmically divergent. So the logarithm creates few problems as you increase higher energy. But quadratic divergence was bad. So he said in the paper, if you read it, he said, this means that the scalar particle is not suitable for doing weak interactions. This is 1939. Now, this has been taken up by Wilson, Toft, and others, and it's known as the Higgs mass hierarchy problem. And it means effectively, as we'll see, that the cutoff has to go into infinity in a renormalizable theory. So the mass of the Higgs boson turns out to be infinite. That's not a nice result, okay? So you need a very large fine-tuning, or infinite fine-tuning to resolve this problem. The problem is that all these particles that were supposed to solve this problem are not there, including supersymmetry. So the problem, we're stuck with this right now. This is one strong reason why you should think about reformulating the theory. Something's badly wrong. Okay, so this is what the Higgs looks like. There it is sitting in there. It's called the bare Higgs, essential Higgs. And all around it is this cloud of virtual particles. Other particles, electrons, Higgs itself, quarks, bosons, whatever. So as you penetrate inside here, you get to the bare Higgs particle. And by the way, Higgs particle is electrically neutral. And this mass, experimental mass, is 125 GeV. So you have the self-energy of the particle itself, the bare particle. But you have to calculate all this extra energy due to all this stuff. And when you do that, you find it's infinite, or incredibly large. And this is not good. Okay? For the case of the electron, a similar situation arises, or the proton. The electron has this cloud of virtual photons around it. But the gauge theory of electron-photon interactions is valid. And also, there's a symmetry between matter and antimatter, as Dirac discovered. And that symmetry, when you work it out, solves the problem. So that the extra energy due to the cloud for the electron is not a problem. So how would you solve this problem? Find another symmetry. So lo and behold, supersymmetry comes along. So there's a symmetry between the partners and their super partners. And when you put that in and it works, it solves that problem. The problem is it doesn't exist experimentally. Okay, so that dashes that hope, understanding. This is why the lack of supersymmetry discovered is a bad news out there in the physics community if you read articles and blogs about it. This is not a happy campus situation. Okay, so these are Feynman graphs. These are the tree graphs. And these examples of the loop graphs. Tree graphs are effectively at the classical level. There are no divergences. And all the particles that have been discovered make sure that the so-called unitarity for the tree graphs is not violated. I'll get to that. But the loops are the problem. These are the quantum corrections, the so-called relative corrections. This is where the quantum physics comes in to the standard model. Okay, so we've gone through this. Now, what is renormalizability? What it says is the following, that you have this bare charge and bare mass, and you have the relative corrections, the delta M's and delta E's. And the bare charge turns out to be infinite when you calculate it. So you say, well, the relative correction part, the delta M, delta E, delta M squared, delta E, is also infinite. So you subtract one infinity from another, and lo and behold, you get a finite contribution. And life is great. So this dodgy trickery goes on. And this has been going on since 1947. Do we like it? Depends on your taste, but Dirac didn't like it. And Feynman in his later years was asked about this, and he said, it's just a trick. He said, this can't be fundamental. There's a more fundamental understanding of this. Anyway, so what you do is you put all the masses to zero, you borrow from condensed matter physics, and you break this spontaneously break the vacuum of the system using this scalar particle, the Higgs, it's called the Higgs mechanism, and you get a false vacuum, and you have a true vacuum, and you get a Mexican hat, and so on. And then you claim that the Higgs field gives masses to the particles, the fermions and the bosons. How do we know this is correct? I mean experimentally. We have not been able to say anything about this magical potential V of phi, which has lambda phi to the fourth, which gives you the false vacuum. Because we know nothing experimentally about the self-energy of the Higgs particle. I'll get to that. Also, it turns out that you cannot calculate any of the masses this way. So they're just arbitrary coefficients. And this is why you have 26 free parameters, if you count in the standard model. So it's not quite the situation where you see that the emperor has no clothes, but it's getting to the point where you just have to trust in the physics without any real true experimental determination of what's going on. As for the Higgs boson, we know that's a problem because the Higgs boson is way off mark, even though you could never calculate in the first place. It was always an issue of what the mass was. So that's the standard model. Now, so what I'm going to show you is a finite quantum field theory, and the point is that With a finite quantum field, you do not have to do infinite renormalization. All everything's finite. So you don't have to worry about the W boson. It works out. And you don't have to put the masses to zero at the beginning to get a gauge symmetry. What you get, SU2-CoSU1, is a broken symmetry. It's a broken symmetry because the masses are not zero. So I start with that. I apply my finite quantum field theory, and it all works out. So I end up putting in the experimental masses and the experimental coupling constants. I still get a kind of electroweak theory, unification of electromagnetism and weak interactions with a broken group. The group is broken, okay? The masses of the WZ are 83 and 91 GeV, so there isn't any question about it. So that's the motivation for the reformulation of the theory. Now, I get the same experimental results, as I'll show, as the Steiner Marlin present. And so it's a reformulation, as Dirac said. You try to reformulate theories in a different way. However, you may discover something while doing that, also experimentally. So it's a worthwhile exercise. Okay, so what is this? I have two scales, energy scales that come in, or length scales. You need them, they're finite scales, and you need them to do a finite quantum field theory. One is lambda H, which is controls the Higgs particle interactions, and one is lambda M, which controls all the other particle interactions. So if you have a Green's function, then the regularized propagator is for the Klein-Gordon operator is given here. Delta squared is the regularized propagator, epsilon curly E, and it's equal to this.
Can I ask one question before we start section three?
Sorry, what?
Can I ask one question before
Please.
We start section three? So in the normal standard model, one nice thing is that you get certain predictions, like you predict that the mass of each fermion, because the masses of the fermions arise by spontaneous symmetry breaking.
Yes.
That the mass of each fermion is proportional to its coupling to the Higgs.
Okay. V is the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs field, which is a 246 GeV. That's the electroweak symmetry breaking. Right.
Right. And then there's still the fluctuation term couples to the two quark, where the Higgs couples to the quark.
Right.
And itself. And so that there you can test that prediction. Or is it true that the masses of the top quark, bottom quark, etc.
All the particles
are proportional to their decay width. The
right. All the data.
So if you start with a theory where the symmetry is broken from the start, do you still predict those relationships?
Yes.
Or are they free parameters?
When you do any calculation, for example, decay products of the Higgs or any other particle, you put in experimental masses into the amplitude. Okay, you don't use this. I mean, you can, but from a practical point of view, you have to put in the masses of the particles, which is what I do. So I get the same answer from tree graphs as you do for standard.
So I guess I'm saying if you look at the, you can measure two different things in the standard model. You can measure the ratio of the mass of the top to the mass of the bottom. Let's say you measure that. And then, let's say you measure two different decay channels of the Higgs. You measure its decay to tops, and you measure its decay to bottoms. So those are two different ratios, but and then in the standard model, it's predicted that this ratio is the square of this ratio. Does that have to be true? Why does that have to be true?
Well, because when I calculate those two decays, I take the ratio, and I get the same answer. I have to know cosine theta. I'll explain that. But cosine theta can be determined experimentally. So it all comes out the same. Provided lambda AM is greater than 10 TV, whatever it is, before you start turning over the theory to higher energy above lambda M. Okay.
I believe that it all comes out the same if you use the measured values.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, in certain, you know, there's certain constraints among the measured values in the standard model which follow from the fact that the theory is ultimately spontaneously broken, has a spontaneously broken symmetry.
Right.
My question is, do you predict?
I will show you. Actually, I'm getting there. I have to move on more rapidly. One thing you have is that you have Mw over Mz equal to cosine theta. This is the weak angle. So in the case of the standard model, you have 1/2 g v. And Mw z equals 1/2 g prime v g v square root of g squared plus g prime squared. Okay. However, if you put in experimental masses, it tells you what cosine theta is. So you can argue about whether that's really a prediction or not. I don't think so. Anyway, I'll get to this. The point is that for the broken symmetry, I still have a broken symmetry. I can explain where it is and what it is. Okay, so running along quickly, this is called a distribution. And when lambda x goes to zero, you get back the local theory. So in distribution theory, you can use Bobacki-Schwarz test functions to smear out fields. But basically, you're assuming that all interactions, the vertices, are point interactions, delta functions. Delta functions were introduced by Dirac for quantum mechanics, but also in his pioneering work on deriving a quantized radiation, electromagnetic radiation. So,
John, sorry to interrupt. Are you going to derive this from? Do you derive this from something, or is this your assumption?
It's derived from distribution theory in mathematics.
No. Wait. So you have your modified propagator that you want to write down.
Yes.
Or
vertices.
Is that your assumption, or are you going to derive it from something?
It's an assumption. Derived delta function is an assumption. Obviously.
Okay. So you're just kind of doing that by hand. And it's also going to be...
The right delta function is done in by hand, obviously. You have to choose a distribution.
I don't want to argue about that. And it's also going to be non-zero outside the light cone? So
I'm getting there. It's a very important question. Okay, so running on, you find this... So what I've done is gone from the simplest possible distribution in mathematical distribution theory, which is delta function, to the next simplest one, which is a Gaussian. Okay? And if you go to the Gaussian, the next simplest one, all infinities disappear. So why didn't you use it in the first place? Why do you have to have all these infinities to worry about? It's called groupthink, or cognitive bias, okay, over many years. Okay, so there it is. There's your Gaussian, and this is in momentum space. And this lambda p determines the uncertainty in knowing. It's the amount of uncertainty away from the delta function, which occurs here. delta function comes about when the lambda p goes to zero, so the uncertainty goes to zero, and you get the point particle delta function. Also, we can then turn to this statement that lambda x in the x space and lambda p product is greater than or equal to h bar. So what happens is that when lambda x goes to zero, and the equivalent picture for x space, if you're going to smaller distances, the lambda p is increasing, and the Gaussian is getting bigger and bigger. So there's more uncertainty in momentum if you try to measure a small distance. And vice versa, if you try to measure accurate momentum at the LHC proton collision, you're going to get a bigger and bigger uncertainty in the measurement of the position of the particles. This is a very important point. Okay, so causality. Well, it turns out that if you define this here as a non-local operator in terms of this distribution operator E curly of x, then f of x, f of e, or f of x has to be an entire function. It's got to be an entire function. Entire function is such that it's holomorphic and in the p squared or x squared plane, and it can be Taylor series expanded in an infinite number of derivatives. So there are an infinite number of derivatives attached to the entire function. And it's also analytic everywhere in the complex p-squared plane, except at infinity. And by Liouville's theorem, there has to be a singularity at infinity. Otherwise, the entire function is constant. So you work it out, and you find this result for the commutator, the vacuum exchange value of the commutator of these two non-local operators. Here it is. So it turns out for x minus x prime squared space-like, we can perform a Lorentz transformation on the second term, yielding this result, and that gives you zero. So this is a proof that non-local field theory does not violate microscopic causality. An alternative proof is given by Stanislav Ogarkov, Moscow University. When he read my proof, he said, "I'm not sure I believe this." He went away and redid it, and he said, "You're correct." And the reason is he used the Pauli-Jordan propagator for the commutator of these two fields. These are non-local. And again, when you do this, you find that for space-like separation, they are commutator zero. So this means that in quantum mechanics, as we know it, quantum mechanics is non-local because of the entanglement, quantum mechanical entanglement. And what we say is that there's no way of information being transmitted between two events by speed of light, namely space-like separation. That's the basis of quantum mechanics as far as causality is concerned. So now I've proved the same is true for non-local field theory. Non-local field theory is causal, and it satisfies microscopic causality. Now, this has the important fact that when you derive Hamiltonians in non-local field theory, you can have what's called a time-ordered product, which is only true if the commutator of two field operators is zero for space-like separation. So it all goes through very nicely. I think this is a very important result. I don't know why it took me this long to prove such a trivial thing, but it did. Okay, so very quickly, you go through here, you separate the action into two parts, free and interaction, and put in your entire function. These are the regulated propagators using what's called Schringer proper time formalism. And these are the equivalent Feynman propagators. using time order operators, vacuum intensifiers of them, and you work out the anomalous results for triangle fermion graphs, and I get back 5 pi naught to 2 gamma. This has all been published. So now we come to the Callan-Zermanski equation, which for our length scale lambda I is given here. Lambda I are these energy scales or inverse length scales. This is called the beta function. That's the anomalous part of the Callan-Zermanski equation. Now, in string theory, when you have in string theory, you have this blob in perturbative string theory. And in string theory, the blob, the vertex in string theory, these are strings, has this factor, exponential minus alpha prime p squared, where alpha prime is the string tension. So all the loops in Euclidean space in string theory are non-local, and in four-dimensional space-time, the claim is that string theory is finite. That's why string perturbation theory is finite. So it's the same as I'm doing all along since Gross, Yevich, 1987. They showed this. However, I'm working in four dimensions. I don't want to work in 11 or 10 dimensions. No one's ever experimentally detected a higher dimension, spatial dimension above 3. And that's still true, by the way, for the LHC. They've looked for higher dimensions, not found them. They look for in missing transverse energy collisions. Okay, electroweak sector. This is the electroweak Lagrangian. And you have the B mu and the W mu as usual. And this is the QED Lagrangian, the mass of the photon is zero, but you put in the mass of the fermions. And for the Higgs, you have the mass of the Higgs. And for the electroweak, you put in explicitly the masses of the fermions and the vector particles, which means you have a broken symmetry. SU2Q1 is broken. So this caused problems for years because of renormalizability. For me, it's not a problem because I have these vertices for the coupling constants for the different interactions using this entire function, which damps off in Euclidean momentum space. Okay, so we can write the boson and fermion masses this way, W to B. And this fermion mass part includes massive neutrinos. So we write as usual W plus minus this way in terms of W3, W1, and W2. Z mu is this mixing. Cosine theta, sine theta, W are the mixing angles. A mu is given here, so on. And this is the weak, the Lagrangian can be rewritten this way.
Could you go back 2 slides?
Yeah.
Where are the Yukawa couplings?
Sorry, what?
Where are the terms with the Yukawa couplings?
I haven't put them down, but I can write them on the blank.
Yeah, because that was what my question was about
So in the Yukawa Lagrangian, which is a purely classical Lagrangian, you have these contributions here involving the Higgs. I didn't put it in, but it's classical. And by the way, that's one reason why you don't get a calculation of the absolute values of particles. You can't expect that from a classical Lagrangian. In atomic physics, quantum mechanics, the hydrogen atom is not described by a classical Lagrangian in order to get the hydrogen energy levels. It's a quantum effect, quantum physics. So you can never expect to hope to get the mass spectrum of fermions and the other particle masses. It's not there. It never was. So the hope is that you can get the masses from a quantum field theory calculation. And I've published papers trying to do this using what's called Schrödinger-Dyson equations. And I had to say my efforts failed. but it's difficult, okay? Maybe we're not supposed to calculate the masses. Maybe it's gravitational. Okay, so here we have it. We have a broken SU2 because you want symmetry. And what I can do is write the mass Lagrangian this way. And when you work this out, you get a zero determinant, zero in the determinant, and out comes this, where B is the scale of broken symmetry. The symmetry is broken. But B is not the vacuum excitation value of the scalar field. Just broken symmetry. I don't know the origin of B, but it's there, okay? So when you work it out, the photon mass comes out zero, you get the W to Z, and you get this mass here, for the Lagrangian for the masses. The fact that the photon comes out zero mass is not a prediction. It's just a cross-check for the QED Lagrangian. Okay, perturbative unitary in the Higgs boson sector. So it turns out you do need a Higgs boson, because the W meson comes, the scattering of W meson's longitudinal parts produces this result for the amplitude. And it, when you square it up, amplitude to get the probabilities, it goes like the energy to the fourth power, which is very bad news for unitarity. And it violates unitarity around 700 or 800 GeV, below TeV. So the whole perturbation theory breaks down. This was a serious problem for years. And according to people like Martinus Veltman, that's the real reason for having a Higgs boson. So when you work out the exchange for the Higgs boson for this, you get this result, which is exactly the opposite sign to that. And unitarity is saved, perturbation theory is saved. So I need a Higgs boson. This is the B, by the way. If you work it out, it's this number. We know the Fermi constant. It comes out at 246 GeV. Good. I haven't lost anything, okay? Okay, very quickly, these are the results I get from tree graphs. This is your question. I put in the masses. I get this tree graph result for rho. But I have to know what the cosine theta W is. It's given experimentally. I've done work on Higgs radiative corrections. And they're very small. This plays an important role. Now, Higgs mass hierarchy problem, we're getting near the end. This is the scalar Higgs mass, Higgs field Lagrangian. And this is, you have to do renormalization theory because you're doing perturbation theory. And, but all the renormalization constants are finite. So these are what you get. This is the propagator in the Euclidean momentum space. This is the propagator for the Higgs. This is the one-loop boson self-energy in terms of the incomplete gamma function. Okay. So when you expand the incomplete gamma function, m over h small, you get this. There you go again. There's the quadratic divergence, the culprit. So if we choose this lambda h, which controls the Higgs particle sector, to be between 201 GeV and 1 TeV, this is what you find, where MH is 125 GeV. It's of order 1. So the Higgs mass hierarchy problem has gone away. It's been resolved. That's the prediction, one prediction. So here we get this result, which solves the Higgs mass hierarchy problem. So now we go to finite renormalization group and triviality problem. What you find is for four vertex, Higgs vertex, you get this delta lambda. This is radiative correction. And for this is in the standard model. This is the RG equation. And we obtain this result for the inverse of renormalized coupling constant for the Higgs. Note this. So we now get back to Landau in 1954-55. So what you find is that when you invert this, you get this result. Landau noticed the bare Higgs constant without the cloud of particles. So what Landau is saying is that lambda cutoff has to be infinite. The lambda phi to the fourth is a renormalizable theory. Lambda phi to the sixth isn't, by the way. Most quantum field theories are not renormalizable, incidentally. And lambda c has to be infinite, exactly infinite. Otherwise, you violate unitarity, ellipticity, and Lorentz invariance. That's the definition of renormalizability, according to Dyson. So what he said was that lambda renormalizes was zero. Lambda z is infinite, so the coupling is zero. All you get is free fields. It's called the triviality problem. And he did this for quantum electrodynamics. He showed in 54, 55 that quantum electrodynamics simply doesn't exist because there are no couplings, no coupling in renormalizable theory. He was right. I was a young student at the time at Cambridge, and there was a great to-do about all this. Conferences were held, and arguments took place, and there were sides, and Schrödinger was arguing with Landau and so on. But no one ever convincingly showed he was wrong. Okay, so what happens for finite QFT, as I call it? Here's again the result of the incomplete gamma function. You expand this and you get this result. Back to the result from original result from the standard model. So you now know the beta function. It's this integral here, incomplete gamma function. You work it out. And this is what you get, where J is given by this integral. Lambda H is the energy scale that controls the Higgs sector. So what happens? Well, this is a standard model result. There's a Landau pole in the Higgs field, in the lambda, the renormalized coupling constant. What do we get in the finite quantum field theory? It's lovely, it's smooth and finite. It just goes down to zero for given values of the bare coupling constant. So when mu increases for fixed lambda h, the renormalized coupling constant goes to the bare. You're going way deep inside the cloud and you're hitting the Higgs itself. This is wonderful. It's all finite, it works. And now these are the actual quantities coming into the calculation. This is the standard model. The green, you notice it goes through zero, whereas for the J from the incomplete gamma function, it's positive. Okay, so that resolves the triviality problem because lambda H is of order TV. And besides, renormalized coupling constant never goes to zero. It doesn't go through zero. So here we have it again. The physical charge in QED goes to zero as lambda c, the cutoff goes to infinity, which it has to do in renormalizable QED. So the stability of the vacuum, in a few words, here there's no problem. In the standard model, there's been a lot of papers published about the fate of the universe because of the false vacuum. The false vacuum is symmetrical. It comes down V of phi to the true vacuum, where the vacuum excitation value of phi is zero. And it's not stable. So the question is, where does the instability occur? And it could occur such that the universe ceases to exist a long time from now. I won't be around, but anyway, I guess people have to worry about it. And in the case of this finite QFT, there is no instability. There's only one vacuum. It's a true vacuum. Namely, the true vacuum is phi Higgs is zero. That's it. Stable. So let's get to the last part. I'm over time. A few more minutes. Experimental results. Well, what we're predicting is that the radiative corrections for the Higgs and the other particles damp out in Euclidean momentum space for values greater than these lambdas, energy scales, because the entire function damp out in Euclidean momentum space exponentially fast. That's the prediction. And this has to be checked experimentally. Also, this could explain the potential desert that's occurring. I don't think we're ever going to see more new particles. Doesn't matter what energy you go to, right up to the Planck energy, 10 to the 19 GeV. How do you explain this? Well, this theory explains it, because the amplitudes damp off at very high energies. So you don't expect new particles. That's the prediction of the theory. It has predictions, experimental predictions. So the problem is that in order for the Higgs itself, they shut down the Large Electron-Positron Collider in 2000. This was the original tunnel that started up the tunnel for the LHC. And they shut it down at 200 GeV. If they had, you need an electron-positron collider to do Higgs experiments, because you can't do them with two protons colliding. It's too messy. So we need a circular electron-positron collider at an energy greater than 400 GeV because of the threshold. Twice the top mass is 344 GeV. That plays an important role in determining the Higgs radiative corrections and the Higgs self-energy itself. That's going to be very difficult to do, by the way. You can't use WZs and Higgs as projectiles and targets in collisions, because they only last around 10 to the minus 22 seconds. So they only go 10 times the radius of the proton inside the accelerator. So this is why we use proton and electron colliders, okay, because they're stable particles. This makes life very difficult. Anyway, this is the prediction here. Lambda H has to be less than 1 TeV. So there's been a lot of controversy recently about whether we should have a new accelerator. And some people say, yeah, no. Some people say, yes. And CERN has produced a design project called the FCC, Future Circular Collider, which has an electron-positron collider as well as a proton-proton collider built in, up to 100 TeV. Okay? So we can get electron-positron collisions up to a TeV or more, higher. This is wonderful. The cost is going to cost between $10 and $15 billion. It'll take 30 years or more. The cost of building the Gerald R. Ford aircraft carrier by the US was $13 billion. And that was over a period of 5 years. This collider is cost $10, $15 billion. Is over 30 years, and many countries will be involved. So it's not all that big a deal financially. What do we expect to see? I don't know. This is what we do in physics. We explore nature, and you can't do that without experimental physics. Without experimental physics, you don't have physics. You can construct all the theories you want and speculate, but you can't test them. So we have to build this accelerator, in my personal opinion. That's my contribution to this controversy. Finally, just quickly, you can do all of this for quantum gravity. And again, you do have this perturbation theory. You have to be able to use perturbation theory. And we have a graviton, which probably never can be detected. As Dyson famously said, to have a detector that can detect a graviton, say from the graviton radiation from the sun, you need a mass that's so big that it would collapse to a black hole. And he has all sorts of other reasons why you won't detect. Recent tabletop experiments to detect gravitons have all failed to do so. Anyway, we play the game, and it turns out that the theory is finite to all orders, of unitarity. It satisfies unitarity for the S matrix, for graviton-graviton scattering, graviton off other particles, and Lorentz invariance locally is satisfied. Diffeomorphism is satisfied. It's everything you want in a perturbation theory up to near the Planck mass. And by the way, it turns out that the amplitudes are damped off. So by the time you get to the Planck energy, there is no much quantum gravity left. So you don't really need a full theory of quantum gravity for strong gravity at the Planck energy. So, regarding quantum gravity, there are all these quantum gravity theories. And in this case, I'm frustrated because I can calculate a graviton scattering amplitude for you, and it's radiative correction, so I've done it. But I can't test it because there are no quantum gravity data. How can I do physics without data? As Sherlock Holmes said to Watson, capital mistake to hypothesize without data. And this has been the case for 80 years. Quantum gravity has been going on for over 80 years, actually. And where are we? We have all these theories, loop quantum gravity, string theory, and so on. And this theory, I can't test it. Thank you.
I don't know, should we allow questions or not lay them? It's up to you.
Yes.
Okay. So John Cole, I understand correctly, you want to take the action and modify the gradient terms to put in this entire function that you're going to choose. Is that correct? Okay, so the problem with that is we have a severe Ostrogosky issue and...
You have a what?
Ostrogosky type issue. You're going to add higher derivative terms and some of us would claim all those things are inevitably have Hamiltonians that are unbounded from below. We're dead.
Okay, the answer is that, as in string theory, you never truncate the derivatives.
Yeah, that doesn't happen.
You don't do it because you obviously have the function, it's an analytic function. Why would I truncate this derivative?
No, it's not an issue of truncation.
So this theory does not have, if you include all the derivatives, you can trivially show it. There are no ghosts. It's all stable.
No, so the Ostrogosky issue, well, okay, I don't want the words in your mouth, so, and make whatever argument you like, of course. But the
what is the issue?
The problem is you will get a term in the Hamiltonian that is unbounded from below, and whether the function is entire or not is completely irrelevant to this. Doesn't matter one way or the other.
What's unbounded?
The Hamiltonian.
This is not true. There are papers I can give you references.
Okay, we should probably say that. It's a straightforward thing to show.
Papers have been published showing that non-local, non-local quantum field theory can be developed as a Hamiltonian theory. You doubt it?
I say it's flat out false and it's not hard to show.
Well, you have to prove it. So I wait your proof.
Okay. I can tell you, Right. So making a function, you know, higher derivatives but entire doesn't change things at all. The problem that you will get is just the same.
I guess usually people say that you know, the issue is that if the propagator has more than two poles, that's
so the problem is, well, this is what I think people normally mean, but I don't want to assume what people mean, but it's just flat out, it's easy to show, and it's flat out false that locating the poles is a good indicator of instabilities in higher derivative theories. It's just, so you can write down the simple thing, you know, either delta exponential of delta phi squared or delta squared phi, that's unbounded from below, despite the fact it's as nice a thing as you could ever want. So poles are just not a good indicator for higher derivative
theories. E to the del squared phi.
Yeah. And, well, if you have a hard time doing that, come and talk to me and I'll lead you through step by step. But
you come and talk to me.
So my claim is you can prove, you will be able to prove to yourself within a few minutes.
I've looked all for some years. I've looked at all of these issues, and I haven't found anything wrong with this. So
the action you're talking about is phi e to the,
well, just e to the del squared phi, and just the nicest
sandwiched by phi's.
Oh, I was writing down the action.
E to the minus del squared phi.
Yeah, we need some constant fair dimensions. Some constant del squared phi. That is a battle from below.
It's what?
Type issue, you get
the phi is up in the
sure.
In the exponent of the variable.
Yeah.
Whereas John, what?
I couldn't entirely tell.
Phi's not in the exponent.
That's okay. There's a slightly longer story in that case, which I don't want to get on my soapbox. But basically, so the argument is a little less straightforward if your expressions involve individual terms up to arbitrary. So functions of a finite number of derivatives, this argument is straightforward. If it's an infinite...
No, there's always, you must never truncate it. The same is true in string theory. In string theory, as soon as you truncate the derivatives, you have a problem.
That,
you don't do that.
Okay? No, that has nothing to do with it. In fact,
this is a standard result in string theory.
You're just wrong about this, John. In fact, the thing that cures the string theory problem is that it's truncated. You have an SL2Z symmetry. That's what saves you from the UDU reminder.
No, if you have truncated derivatives, you start worrying about ghosts.
But if you have something which involves...
Those are two different truncations you guys are talking about, though. I mean, that's the SL2Z is a truncation of the space over which you're integrating. He's talking about truncating the polynomial and derivatives in a finite order.
That's true. I'm just saying that the solution in string theory, if it is a solution, doesn't come from where you think it comes from. But if your theory, on the other hand, involves individual terms with infinite number of derivatives, not any individual term of the function, then that theory is non-predictive. So it's non-measurable, it's non-calculable. I can't see what the point of it is. That's the kind of argument I'd love to hear.
One of the problems with developing Hamiltonian formalism is the problem of microcausality. Because if you don't have a time-ordered product in standard quantum field theory, perturbation theory, it's very difficult to construct a Hamiltonian by Wick's theorem. Okay? And I've just proved that the microcausality holds for non-local field theory, so that is a problem that's gone away. It doesn't exist. Anyway.
Well, I would maybe I'll just... My own thought is that it seems like there's two things you're proposing. One is, you know, replacing delta functions by entire functions, and the other thing is working with a theory that in which SU2 times U1 is not spontaneously broken. I think it is the case that second thing we can talk afterwards, but I think that that second thing makes predictions about the relations between coupling constants, which some of which have been tested.
Do I have those?
I don't think so.
Well,
when you showed the decay amplitude for H goes to fermion,
yes.
You must have assumed there that the Yukawa coupling is equal to the mass divided by the VeV.
No.
How could you direct?
Well, because it's an old formula. It's a scalar particle decaying into fermions. This has been known. So I just you just plug in the masses and it's what you get from tree graphs. Tree graph calculation.
To derive that formula, you need the vertex for Higgs to fermion. So that's a Yukawa coupling. But there was no Yukawa.
No, I don't need a Yukawa coupling. It's just straightforward. It's in the textbooks. You don't use Yukawa to do it.
How does the Higgs decay?
You can, by the way. You can replace all the masses by putting in Vs, if you like. But it doesn't buy anything.
How does the Higgs decay to the two fermions without the Yukawa coupling?
Higgs decays into two fermions, fermion, antifermion. It's electrically neutral. So it's you go back to 19-something. Textbook, and there it is. I mean, it's a.
All right.
What can I say?
we may have to talk afterwards.
Yeah,
my,
sure.
My impression is that my suggestion would be to keep the spontaneous symmetry breaking by the Higgs doublet, but still then insert. I mean, it's logical. You could still take the normal Higgs theory and do the entire function replacement. You suggest.
I did that in 1990. In a long paper in Physical Review, I did everything,
right.
Including quantum gravity, by the way,
right.
And not a billion, whatever.
Okay.
And, but I reformulated because I don't think it's there's nothing wrong with the standard model. I'm not saying it's wrong; it's consistent. But when I reformulate it, I get a different picture of what's going on, and different predictions. And these you can actually, in the end, with a collider test. Which is correct. We can't right now, actually, because we don't have an E plus E minus collider. This is most unfortunate they stopped that machine. They should have upgraded it. The Chinese have proposed an E plus E minus collider, but it was going up to TV, but the Chinese government said it's too expensive, cut it back to 500 GeV. It's not good enough. And the future, the FCC, which has just come off a couple of months ago, project, the E plus E minus goes up to 20 TV. I mean, this is wonderful. Okay, so much we can learn from that. We don't understand a lot of what goes on about the standard model yet. This is what I explained. And remarkably, my claim is that I can predict all the same results as what the LHC has seen, like no flavor changing through neutral currents, all of it with this alternative. So I was rather puzzled at the end when finishing this work, because I discovered that I was able to do everything in the standard model does, without all this spontaneous symmetry breaking of the vacuum. That's what I discovered. Why someone else hasn't done this, I don't know. This bothered me, by the way.
I don't agree that it's true.
You have to show me how explicitly the difference comes in.
Sounds good.
Because that's a prediction.
Okay, let's talk about it. Let's talk about it right afterwards, and then let's thank John for a very interesting talk.